Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
You are listening to Ghost in the Valley Podcast with Al Cooley. Hello and welcome to Ghost in the Valley Podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today my guest comes to me with a high recommendation from my friend Peter Broberg. The gentleman's name is Dr. Carl Alton Cook. Carl's book came out about a year ago. It's called The Mayflower Project. And I'm telling you what, you have to get your hands on this book because it's phenomenal. And we're talking on some deep stuff on this episode today. And it's not about the boat, it's about a spacecraft that travels 33,000 years away. And it is what can happen, yes, it's a possibility. No, this actually would take him 33,000 years to get there, over 200 generations. You're born on this craft to die on this craft, and your next generation, and so on and so on. If you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're a hairdresser, then it just goes right down the line to your bloodline. That they're going to become the same thing that you were. Very thought out process. The back cover alone took him years to write. We're going to get into Dr. Carl Alton Cook's, a little about his history, being a retired dentist, a songwriter, now an author. And it's my pleasure to have him on the show today. And we did the interview at Peter Broberg's house. It was an enjoyable interview, enjoyable evening. Peter adds a few of his comments. So I'm really excited about this interview. The first part is we go into his music journey and his process of writing to the book. And you don't want to miss that part. Please, please, please get a copy of this book. It is well worth the read. I read the book. It is fantastic. So here's my conversation with Dr. Carl Alton Cook. So welcome to the show, Carl.
Thank you.
A little bit of your background. Let's go for your music first. Where was your musical influence?
My first musical influence probably was Elvis. You know, late 50s rock and roll. I liked Dion. Certain songs that he did stuck in my mind as a little kid. Of course, the Beatles came along and the British Invasion. So it's not unlike my generation. That's kind of where it started for me.
Yeah, that was mine too. Elvis Presley. So my very first record I ever bought or owned, I should say, was Don't Be Cruel. And I used to love to watch that little dog spin around on the gramophone record.
Well, the flip side was Hound Dog, and I wore them both out.
Right. That double side hit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that led you into becoming a songwriter, or what was that?
Well, I was writing songs before I could play an instrument. I was writing songs in my head, the melodies and the words, in probably fifth grade, I was writing songs. I couldn't even play a guitar yet, but I knew how, you know, to construct the melody in my mind. Didn't need a musical instrument.
Mm-hmm. And you think some of these earlier influences influenced you, too?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think the the American scene was fantastic back in the 50s. And growing, I don't know how old you are.
I'm your guys' age. I'm 69.
So you know, growing up in the 50s, late 50s, and how different it was, the music scene.
Well, I was at the tail end of that. So Elvis was just huge for me. But, you know, when the Beatles came out in 64, then the British invasion, then in America it's shifted into, you had the Motown, which I didn't like when I was a kid. I like it more now than I did then. But the West Coast became important. You know, you had the L.A. bands, you had the San Francisco bands. Mm-hmm. So the West Coast became important.
So, yeah, those days, I can remember certain things from the late 50s and the early 60s and, you know, great, great music scene then. And I hear that in your song, The Magpie.
Which is available if you go on YouTube and put in, we had to change our name because we had a little trouble with one of the other songs. So Amber put it on as the Spam Risk, all one word, Spam Risk musical group, Magpie.
It's a fantastic song. I got it. Once you hear it, I think Peter Broberg, who's also right now, he sent me the song. And once it's in your head, it's hard to get it out.
And it gets in there pretty easily. It's a pretty clean melody.
And that woman, the girl that sang in the song, let's talk about her for a minute. I mean,
Jen Cancio, she's very good. She's very active musically in this area. She's all over the place. She did a show in Columbiana at the converted theater down there. And it was a very well thought out show, which she talked between songs, and there was a logic to her presentation. Really good band behind her. She's pretty talented. I'm very proud to have her on the Magpie, and then we're going to be doing the next song. It's called The Ballad of Peter Bacon.
Okay, and that's where you got from Peter. We were just talking earlier about Peter Ham.
From Badfinger, yeah. It was kind of written in his honor.
Mm-hmm. I just thought she was phenomenal. Who else played on that song?
On Magpie?
Yeah.
Max Chang from Pennsylvania did the guitar work. I played acoustic guitar. Tim Powell played the upright bass. He's from Warren. And Jen Cancio sang. A young lady named Kristen Solars played the violin. She's magnificent. And Amber did the percussion on that song. And let's see, who else? Pete played the ukulele.
Yeah, you're missing our buddy Pete sitting
yeah,
here.
Ukulele. Yeah.
Yeah, and a video. Let's talk about the video, too. You had a video that went along with the song.
Yeah, I would tell Amber, go to this movie, Way Out West, for the footage of Laurel and Hardy. Go to Disorder in the Court by the Three Stooges for Larry Fine playing the violin. And the violin solo kicked in. I says, I saw it on TV. There was a Betty Boop cartoon that featured some crows, which is close enough to a magpie, so she borrowed some of that stuff, and the rest she kind of found on her own. But she's the one that really constructed the video. I can't do that.
So you came up with the melody and a tune?
Melody, the words, yeah. Me and my friend Mike Layfield wrote that song.
Mm-hmm. And you knew what you had in mind to have, who's going to sing it?
I knew I wasn't going to sing because I wanted somebody really good. So I asked the guy who turned me on to the violinist, Krista, Todd Mackey from Boardman, he recommended Jen Cancio, and she really just sang it beautifully.
So it's a one and done, or I mean, are you going to have like a CD out or an album out?
I'm not
out?
Sure what to go with it, because I have two other songs that are done. Mm-hmm. And also, if you go on YouTube, there's one called When the Levee Breaks, not the Led Zeppelin song. This is an original, also Mike Layfield and I wrote. Same title, though, When the Levee Breaks, and it's also on YouTube also. So that's quite a nice visual experience as
under
well.
Under what name?
Well, I think Amber reposted it again as the Spam Risk Musical Group.
Okay. So try to put these links in the bottom of the show notes so you can go listen to Magpie and the other couple.
When the Levee Breaks.
When the Levee Breaks. Anything else coming up? Or?
Well, there's one that would cause some trouble. We're not sure why it got flagged and YouTube removed it. So we haven't decided how to approach putting it back on. The name of that song is The King Has No Clothes. And It's actually a nice video with that one as well. But we haven't figured out exactly what to do with that, get it back on. And with this other song, there'll be four songs. I don't know. Release them? I don't know. I don't know what to do.
Be like a nice little EP, you know?
Yeah, it's got a good start. I mean, four songs. I want to do a copy song or two. There was a song in the 60s. It was a country and western song out of Nashville. The woman singer was Sandy Posey, and the name of the song was Born a Woman. I'm not sure about the sentiments and the lyrics, but I always thought it was a great melody. It's a very, very, a very nice production, and I think it can be improved upon. I wouldn't mind trying to do one copy song.
Let's move on. Let's move on to the book, The Mayflower Project. What was your inspiration of writing this book?
I was watching Carl Sagan on the TV show Cosmos. This was around 1991, possibly. And it was for the first time that somebody really got across to me the hard science of, the hard reality of space travel. You know, I went to bed that night thinking, well, geez, that makes all the science fiction stories and movies and books all just basically nonsense. The distances are too far to think any aliens have ever been on Earth, nor are we ever going to go to any useful distance on a planet. But if you were going to go into deep space, how would you do it? It occurred to me there's only one way to do it. You'd have to have a spacecraft that would be constructed with the possibility of long-term flight, but also you'd be taking aboard expendable crews. So your task is to repair, you know, machinery, or you might be a doctor. So when you have a child, you train your child to take over your task, and you would do it for literally hundreds of generations over thousands and thousands of years. And that's the plot of the Mayflower Project.
So it would have to live on, somebody's given their life up on that ship, right?
Everybody's
given their life up until that final destination.
Right.
That's really, I like that. That's interesting. You know,
well, I thought it was. Nobody ever kind of incorporates that into their stories. It's always battles in space and aliens and kind of undefinable goals and purposes and... The whole purpose of the Mayflower Project was to colonize another planet in the star system Tau Ceti. I tried to use real scientific facts as much as possible. So the numbers I came up with were actually calculated numbers of the distance, the speed the craft might go. The Mayflower is the name of the spacecraft. And how long it would take to get there going such and such a speed. It's all carefully thought through and calculated.
Yeah, because you look at shows like Quantum Leap. You know, so they're doing time travel through, like that's more fantasy.
Completely.
Completely. So, and I have guests on the show who have lost time through being abducted by aliens or a craft. Now I get that more and more time about time travel. But that's interesting about as far as you would have to create life on that craft.
Right.
To have the life to... sustain to and have enough food.
They have a garden section.
Okay, that was my next question.
Yeah, everything was thought through. Anything you can think of, believe me, it's in there, or I thought of it. And just to keep the bloodlines open so we don't have, you know, inbred mutants in 1,000 years.
That was another question.
They took aboard sperm and egg frozen to make sure the bloodlines were clear.
That's really well thought through. Yeah, because you would think about, you know, you could have some problems there with... inbreeding, you know.
Well, it took me not all together at once, but it took me about 10 years to write it. So I didn't just, you know, dash it off. It was a lot of careful consideration.
So you got that idea from what, watching?
Watching Carl Sagan episode of Cosmos, because he was describing the distances, how far they are from one star to another, the distances. And I thought, well, normal Star Trek, Star Wars kind of fantasy is just that. It's fantasy. But if you did want to travel into deep space, how would you do it? You'd have to do it with generations.
So what would be what was your final destination?
The star system's Tau Ceti. There was a felt to be... Tau Ceti, by the way, is a G star, which is like our own sun. And there's a planetary destination that through analysis of the spectrums and, you know, radio spectrums, that they were able to determine that it has life-giving capabilities. life supporting capabilities.
Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me, I don't know, it's like, it's out there, but it's kind of like, could it happen? Probably.
I mean, if it was going to happen, it'd have to be something like this. The only insurmountable problem with space travel, no matter how far you go and for how long you go, probably the most complicated thing is to solve gravity aboard a spaceship. You can't just tie a loop around something and put weights in your shoes to keep you weighed down. So I come up with something that's a reasonable explanation of how they created a gravitational environment there. But that'd be the most critical thing and maybe insurmountable, the problem of gravity.
And how about the fuel for
nuclear?
Nuclear?
Yep, turbines.
And you thought about maybe like having that gravitational pull?
Well, one of the nuclear reactors is devoted to life support. One was for travel, and the other was to create the force of gravity. So there's three separate nuclear reactors aboard the Mayflower. It's a huge craft. It was so large, they actually assembled it in space. They couldn't launch it.
So, I mean, you got this idea from, the show.
Just the idea of the space travel is one thing from the show.
But what made you, the ideas you come up, you ever lay in bed at night and you think about something else, you get up and you write it down.
Well, I actually put that aside for years and years and years. I just thought of it as a scientific mind experiment. I didn't think of it as anything else. But 10 years later, I got to thinking, that is a very compelling plot. I started jotting down ideas. I was thinking originally around the idea of a script, a film. And I still think it'd make a great movie. But I says, no, it's probably easier to get a book published than get a movie made, which isn't necessarily true either.
Well, you never know who's out there listening. So if you're listening, this would be a great movie. I never thought about, making another civilization on this craft. You basically, because you have to make...
Well, they consider themselves another species altogether. They refer to themselves as Homo aloftus, as opposed to Homo sapiens, is what we are. But they consider themselves Homo aloftus. Because what is the nature of being a Homo sapien was being born of the Earth. Being born in a spacecraft, I guess you're another species.
You're right. And you're talking about, that long distance travel. So a lot of different generations.
30-some thousand years. 216 generations. So the book ends at 216, generation 216.
So 216 years? 216 generations.
Yes.
So, So I thought my question was like, you'd have to have, a lot of things have to fall in line for that to even happen. Like, for women to have the baby, to who's going to father and
all that was
recipient,
kind of written into it. I kind of took that into consideration.
So I would jot something down. A lot of people have on my show did the same thing. They would jot things down that would come to them.
Well, I would do that. I would work at it. I'd take my book to work, and between patients, because I was a dentist, between patients, I would work on the book. I worked on it feverishly. At different times.
How many pages is it? Is it in the ebook?
It's available in an ebook form, and the printed form was originally when I had it typed, because I don't type. I had considerably more pages, but they condensed it, and I think got it down to like 178 pages. So it's pretty readable.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard actually to write a book that's self-contained on a spacecraft. There's not a lot you can introduce into the story from outside the craft. In fact, nothing. It all has to take place on the spacecraft.
Right. So the whole story is on that craft.
That's the entire story.
And how big is a craft to...
Several miles long.
So it's a big craft.
It's big. To sustain this kind of life.
I think you're talking about a garden and...
Yeah, they have a huge garden section.
And you would have to
have a unique way of gardening. And there's no sun, of course, but they use high-intensity lights. And the plants are grown on platforms that rotate high up into the canopy of the garden, and these platforms rotate.
We're starting looking at the Mayflower project right now. It's I like the cover.
That took forever to get them to get it right because they kept mucking it up. I finally got them to do it exactly the way I wanted it. I want to introduce the idea of a ship, of course, the Mayflower, but it's in space. So I think it was an interesting, surreal kind of image.
I love the whole concept of it, to tell you the truth. I mean, when Peter Broberg turned me on to your book and your music, he mentioned that you may be a good fit coming on the show. I agreed, you know, because and after reading a little bit of the synopsis of the book, I'm thinking it's
well, the best synopsis is actually that I spent literally years perfecting that.
It was actually at this point, Carl Alton Cook showed me the back cover of the book. And he is correct. This is probably the best synopsis to get of the book is the back cover, which he said took him years to put this together. I want to read the back cover to you right now, then we'll get back into the interview. The World Space Organization, WSO, has taken over NASA and its ill-fated and underfunded space station program. Adhering to the ambitious goals of the WSO, the Mayflower Project becomes an epic journey into the deep space with the purpose of colonizing a planet in the star system Tau Ceti. However, in order to send man's living DNA through this vastness of time and space, the crew must make one supreme and morally corrupt sacrifice. Those aboard will have to reproduce across hundreds of generations, whereby all descendants must bow to the will of their ancestors in order to fulfill the project, culminating in the discovery of the long-forgotten truths about Earth. Generation 216's findings ultimately threaten the Mayflower Project. Breaking from traditional forms of science fiction, this strikingly original story embraces the limitations of today's technology, proposing what might happen if we embarked on such a mission today. Departing from the norm of aliens and intergalactic warfare, the Mayflower Project takes inspiration from the human drama implicit to the journey, while being a cautionary tale of man's inhumanity towards his fellow man. Yeah, we really should pick this book up. It's fantastic. I'm going to get right back into the interview. Back to author Carl Alton Cook.
Well, book two. Any book two in the works? Or?
Well, I don't really feel like writing another book. I have another one that was started. I have a short story that was started. I haven't felt like writing. It's very lonely to sit and write. Very, very lonely. And I just haven't felt like doing it. Actually, I have a very good, if this ever becomes a movie, I have a sequel. This would be a fantastic sequel, maybe better than the original.
And writing a screenplay is another whole different ball.
That's a whole other kind of process.
Because now you're talking a whole different type of writing.
But I've had two men. One guy lives in California. His name is Dennis Thomas. He wrote a treatment of the book as a screenplay. And who's become my friend Todd Mackey, who's worked on my songs, was wanting literally to, he says, well, it's possible to do it ourselves, you know, to make a movie. And they wanted to get behind it and make a movie. I still think that's a great idea. Just, I don't want to necessarily finance it.
Right. You want some back, some type
of.
I
want somebody else to finance.
Right, right. And that's a key with even everything. So I'm trying to get the financing. And I did that through videography. I have my own video company. And I know what it takes to go through copyrights. And
it's very complicated. And I think the sequel would be a very good idea to make into a movie. This would be too. But I don't know. I just haven't felt like writing. But that's all in place. I know exactly where that's going to go. But it's very labor intense because I don't type. I have to sit down and write it all out.
Yeah, because my thing is, if you already had the ending of this book already, that...
Yeah, the ending is... I knew the ending of this before. It was way before it was finished.
So how will you continue a book two or maybe play off of that?
It might supersede this if I ever get around to doing it.
We have our friend here, Peter Broberg. Have you read the book, Pete?
Yes, I read it in its early incarnations. I have yet to read the final version. And I agree. I think the dialogue, it's more of an interpersonal relationship. The dealings within, on the craft, during this journey.
Yeah, it's the human story.
It's the human story. Is what's important here. It's not necessarily the actual...
You could have done it on a submarine almost, but it's not the space and the science fiction isn't that important.
So
it's there. It's part of the story.
Right.
But it's the human drama that unfolds.
And it's more of a... morality and ethics of
going into space.
Generation signing up
I signed up and you signed up, but my kids didn't.
Yeah, your kids didn't, and their entire life to this project, as well as your subsequent
generations. They're forced to.
You know your destiny is going to be on this craft.
Your destiny is going to be on this craft.
Your life has no more meaning than a link in a chain.
So there's going to be a lot of people who's going to have that same.
Well, if you're born to the life, that's what you're going to
accept. True conviction, belief in this concept.
Right. You had no other choice, though. Okay. If you're born as an Eskimo into a village in Alaska, you've got not a heck of a lot of choices.
Well, you're born in this craft, you don't have a choice. I mean,
zero choice.
Yeah, so you know
where you're on board.
Right.
Yeah. In more ways than one, you're on board.
I don't know, it just struck me just when you were talking about returning to Earth and finding how the humans have evolved.
They've evolved, or these folks haven't.
And it kind of clicked in my brain about the old Planet of the Apes series with Charlton Heston, where, you know, now the de-evolution, so to speak, where, you know, man has reverted back to the primate. Whether you believe in that concept or not, but just how the things have been for the sake of the story,
there has to be some conflict, and that would be the foundation of it.
One conflict of
humans, earthbound humans, and the spacecraft.
Or falling in love with that high school sweetheart. I mean, or going through those type of things how would you do, I mean, your life on a craft.
It has to unfold naturally. I didn't want to beat that aspect into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But if your bloodlines are too close, you have to have artificial insemination.
Mm-hmm.
So they keep very careful track of who fathered who beget who. They know the whole entire bloodlines. So when it's possible, you want to marry such and such a gal, fine. Well, what's your bloodlines? Well, they're too close. So you have to do artificial insemination.
You talked about nuclear power to power this craft.
Yes.
How big is that craft? That has to be.
It's huge. It's so big they assembled it in space.
I encourage all of you out there who's listening to read the book, get the book. It's available at Amazon, paperback.
I would caution people that in the stages in which we did this book, I don't type. And I had several different typists. In fact, my main typist became unavailable for a while. So between first sending the book in for final approval, then they sent it back to me, says, do an edit. I don't know how to. I just said, it was already done once. I think you guys lost the edit. Here, this is it. Go ahead and do it. Well, there's quite a few typos in it.
Well, I was told by...
Nothing drastic, but quite a few typos.
I was told by some very professional authors on my show that your readers are very forgiving. So they can look past a few typos.
I don't
typos.
Think some of them are even going to notice.
Right. So they'll look past a few of the errors that's in the book, you know.
But it was...
If the book's good enough, they're going to keep their attention. They're going
to
read it.
It will hold their attention, but I went through it for the first time to make all these corrections. I just did it the other day, and I passed that off to Amber, and she's very adept with the computer, so she fixed... If there's a mistake in there now, in this final edit, I'll eat my hat, although I don't want to eat my hat.
And even like your story, 1960, we had like Lost in Space and Twilight Zone, shows that made you think, you know, that what could possibly be out there. And I had a person on my show who said, if you look through a straight needle, through that little hole in that straight needle, what you're seeing is our galaxy. So everything outside of that is, can you imagine the realm?
Space is really, really vast. And the conditions in which life could exist on Earth, with all the billions of planets out there, I suppose, billions and billions, there was very likely some other possibilities of life. But however, the idea that it would be anything like humanity is ridiculous, because there's so many tosses of the dice that drove life in our direction on this planet. You know, for probably the first 100 million years, life was no more complicated than bacteriums. And then bacterium became able to consume sunlight and carbon dioxide to produce oxygen. And then maybe another 100 million years before you had paramecians. So it was a very slow, arduous process.
Mm-hmm.
And then with mass extinctions of dinosaurs, where the little primates weren't quite fully formed yet, and the little mammals running around, who rose. It's endless tosses of the dice, how life took the path it did on Earth. Endless passes of the dice.
And I like the fact that you're writing this book, you know, you said you took into account of how long it would take you to get from point, how many years from point A to point B, and...
It was 30,000 some years it would have taken to complete
the... And how many generations that was
over? 216 200. Where it stops, though, because there's a crisis and they
abandon. You stopped at 260 or 2...
Well, that's where I stopped the book, but yeah. For them to get back to Earth, it's going to be another 216 generations to get back.
Right, so there's a whole other...
About halfway is where it stops.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carl, I want to thank you for coming on the show, and
I appreciate it.
And maybe we'll talk again and get you back on. And I want to read the book. And Carl Alton Cook,
yes,
go on Amazon. Carl Alton Cook. I'm going to have his links at the bottom of this episode. And thank you for listening. And I'll see you next time on Ghost in the Valley podcast.